Welcome to the Trinity Forum Conversations podcast. Over the next few weeks, we'll be sharing episodes on a variety of spiritual practices that we hope will supplement your reflections during the season of Lent. In today's episode, we'll talk with Mark Buchanan about the ways in which walking can be both a spiritual practice and a means of deepening our connection to the earth beneath us, our fellow travelers, and the God we worship.
A hurry is the enemy of attentiveness. So the love as attentiveness is listening and caring and noticing, cherishing, savoring, being awestruck. These things that we feel in a relationship, I am deeply loved by this person because they notice me. I think that that's how God's built it. And we can't get that if we're moving too fast.
This podcast is an edited version of an online conversation from June of last year. You can find the full video of that conversation with transcript, as well as our full catalog of event videos on our website, ttf.org. And check out the show notes on this episode for links to further resources. Here's Cherie Harder.
Today we'll consider one of the big questions of life. What does it mean to walk with God with what might seem an unusual twist? What does the act of walking mean to the practice of walking with God? For most of us, walking is something we often do and rarely think about. And the spiritual life is so often described as a walk or a journey that it can be easy to dismiss as the comparison is a mere metaphor or even a cliche. But there's a long history to the link between where our feet take us and where our mind goes, between traversing the landscape and exploring ideas or even our own hearts. Of course, many philosophers were known for their treks. Aristotle usually taught or lectured while walking. Kierkegaard claimed to have composed all of his works while on walks. Rousseau once claimed that when he stopped walking, he stopped thinking. And of course, it's become trendy now in a lot of corporations to actually have walking meetings to help spur creative thinking. At the same time, walking has also been long known to be one of the best things one can do to be fit, flexible, and healthy, to live long and age well. But walking can not only loosen our thinking and lengthen our life, it can also reveal and shape our inward orientation, as reflected in the biblical injunction to walk in the light or walk by faith, or the simple invitation of Jesus to come, follow me. So what are the possibilities and implications of the simple act of walking for spiritual formation? Our guest today has argued that these biblical invitations are literal as well as metaphysical, that the act of walking has profound implications for followers of the way, and that walking helps connect us to the earth, our fellow travelers, and the God we worship in unique ways. It's a provocative claim as well as a most intriguing invitation. And so I'm so delighted to introduce our Sherpa for the journey, our guest today, Dr. Mark Buchanan. Mark is a pastor, author, nonprofit leader, and the associate professor of pastoral theology at Ambrose Seminary in Calgary, Alberta. He and his wife, Cheryl, also lead the nonprofit New Story Community, a ministry that promotes the flourishing of Indigenous women. And he's also the author of 11 books, many of them on spiritual formation, including his recent work, God Walk, Moving at the Speed of Your Soul, which we've invited him here today to discuss. Mark, welcome.
Cherie, I'm so glad to be with you and your listeners and watchers.
I'm excited for our conversation today.
Me too.
As we start out, I'd love to just get the story behind the story. What led you to write this book?
Yeah, I mean, there's three levels, and one is interesting to me, but probably not to anybody listening. I had a contract with HarperCollins, and I owed them a book. So I had to find something that I cared deeply enough about to generate, you know, 250, 300 pages on. Second reason that maybe is more valuable to listeners is I don't write out of my expertise. I write out of my curiosity and out of my need. So I was deeply curious about what was happening. I've always been a walker and loved it, but not thought much about it. And I got curious about that. But I also, most of my books are self-therapy. I'm trying to correct something or restrain something in me. And I'm a person always in a hurry. And so a lot of my books have been about slowing down, quieting down, being more attentive. The third reason is I had a growing irritation, if that's the right word, that the most incarnational faith, religion on the earth, Christianity, had no corresponding physical discipline. So we didn't have a yoga or a tai chi or karate. And so there's a sort of we're plagued by a kind of Gnosticism or dualism in Christianity throughout its history. And I just was bothered that we didn't have anything where we say we embody our beliefs and our faith in these specific ways, this physiology. And then I discovered, from the beginning, walking with God in the cool of the day, the Adam and Eve, and all of the language around walking, and then all of the reality that the people who are the Bible's about or written by were doing most of their thinking through walking, that I think it's always been there, that walking has been the primary practice of the Christian faith. And so I just set out really to partly just discover that or see if that was so, and then what happens when we walk. So those were the three motivations.
Wow. So, you know, in your work that you've mentioned that one aspect of walking as a spiritual discipline is not just keeping company with God, but keeping pace with God at a pace that you called Godspeed. You've also mentioned that, I think, or maybe you were quoting someone, around 3 miles an hour is the speed of thought. And I think you even speculate perhaps the speed of our souls. So what is Godspeed? What's the connection with 3 miles an hour, and how is that the speed of our souls?
Yeah, so good. Well, Godspeed actually is about 1,000-year-old English blessing and coming out of the Middle Ages. And it was something you wished upon somebody's journey, that they would go at Godspeed. And it carried more, not just a sense of the pace at which you walk, but the one with whom you walked and the watching over of the one that walked with you. But the idea of the 3 mile an hour God, I got from the Japanese theologian Kosaku Koyama, who back in the 70s was really trying to think through what ministry or mission would look like in Vietnam post the Vietnam War, and really was seeing the kind of a managerial, maybe corporatized ways of thinking about faith and missions coming out of the American mission scene, and really was saying that actually we got to slow down. And he wrote a lovely book called The 3 Mile an Hour God. And then Rebecca Solnit's lovely book, Wanderlust, she talks a bit about that. The idea is that I think at 3 miles an hour, I mean, obviously it's a metaphor for the pace at which God moves, but there's a sense that God is in no particular hurry. There's very rare instances where we can document or see in scripture that God's in some kind of fired up hurry to get things done. So even when there is sort of an urgency to God's action, it's usually got a long kind of lead up to that moment where things were kind of happening and God was preparing. And the sense that is sort of built into the whoop and wharf of his creation, including us, and that maybe some of the deep work of God really happens at about 3 miles an hour at this God speed, that in the depths of us, we will miss certain things if we don't have a practice of going slowly.
So I'd be curious what God speed means for you, in that, as just thinking about that concept, moving at 3 miles an hour is, well, countercultural sort of on both ends, in that we kind of in general are both much more sedentary and much more hurried than moving at 3 miles an hour. And we were talking about this a little bit earlier, just, you know, your bio, you're a nonprofit leader, a pastor, a professor, a father, a husband, you produced 11 books. You're not an ambler. You had to move quickly. So what does a Godspeed mean for you, juggling so many different responsibilities?
Well, coming back to my earlier remark that a lot of my books, and this one in particular, is self-therapy. It's helping some of the behaviors and inclinations in myself to go too fast, to hurry. I eat fast, I drive fast, I think fast. And yet that hasn't always been a benefit to any of the things you just named, the writing, the nonprofit that my wife and I have is with Indigenous women cycling out of addiction. And this work is slow. And any attempt to rush things, to be impatient, is actually, it's not neutral, it causes harm. And so I really, what 3 miles an hour has meant for me is a deliberate slowness. Because of my haste and my always, when I get in the car, I'm in a hurry, I want to get from this point to that point very quickly, I have started taking the slow work or slow route to work that just slows me down, and the speed limit is considerably less than if I go on the highway, et cetera. I get to see more interesting things. It would be a rare day that I didn't go for a fairly significant walk, and I'm not in competition with myself. I'm not trying to, or anybody else. I don't go on those apps where, you know, we try to outdo each other. I'm not critiquing that. It just doesn't serve me well because of my natural inclinations are to compete, to be in a hurry, to be better than. And I need to do this for the sole reason that it's good for my soul, it's good for my heart, it's good for my relationship with God and myself and the creation and others. So really it is taking myself, carrying myself. I mean, that's one of the beauties of walking, but carrying myself slowly. And Godspeed is, I have to really build in a significant walk into my day for all the reasons I've written about and we will talk more about. But it really is part of this practice of space, noticing, quietness of spirit, etc.
You know, one of the aspects of walking that comes up repeatedly, you know, in almost every different chapter is the attentiveness walking, you know, can produce. And, you know, in regards to place, there's both an attentiveness and a connectedness in that when we walk, we literally see all the transitions. There's connections between localities. But you also said this, which I thought was beautiful, that one of the mysteries of walking is that it keeps driving a place deeper into us and yet keeps opening up its secrets if we are attentive. So what is it that you think about it is about walking that more deeply connects us to a place, a particular place, even as our scenery is changing as well?
Yeah. I mean, the ground under you, actually, and I explore this partly in the book, that walking earth, rather than say a paved or asphalt surface, and sometimes we can't help that just given where we live, but walking the actual earth does something in terms of our calibration of our sense of balance, does something in terms of muscular muscle and bone formation. It doesn't happen when we walk just sort of hard, flat surfaces. But the feeling the earth under our feet, there's something very deeply sacred about that. My wife and I have some property that we're developing, 5 acres, mostly wood with trails all through it. And we go there fairly often. And every time we walk significant portions of it, I'm constantly kind of feeling this rootedness and yet this endless discovery. Every time I walk that land, I discover something new about it. My intent, once I actually develop something there and move there, is I'm going to try to find out everything about every animal, every insect, every plant, on that part, the kind of rocks, where they come from, the composition of them. I'm going to be a student of that land and the depths. I mean, I know if I even get, you know, 20 more years and I get to be on that land a lot, that I will only literally have scratched the surface of it. This is to me a thing of such, I mean, what God is hidden in plain sight in his creation under our feet, that we actually trample the thing. And yet it's there for our benefit, our wonder, our formation. This is just glorious to me. And the older I get, the more glorious it becomes, the more sensitive I am to the insects that, other than mosquitoes, which of course are messengers of Satan, but next to that, I mean, I just am fallen in love with that whole world of these tiny little things that inhabit the ground and the earth and the trees.
You know, as you're talking, I think about the fact that there is a real link between attentiveness and love. And you've also talked in your book that sort of a similar thing happens between feeling connected to the earth and feeling connected to others. At one point you said that many of your friendships that have gone the deepest are those people that you have walked with.
Yeah.
And I think you also said that your prayer life, in your words, roars to life as you walk. And would love to hear you say a little bit more about what you see as the connection between walking and love.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I think it was Simone Weil that said that love is paying attention. And so all of us probably have had the experience of somebody that we think loves us, and yet we have to keep telling them the same stories about ourselves because they haven't listened. And then at some point, we sort of wonder if there's a touch of narcissism or something in that person. That I just feel so deeply loved when somebody's listening deeply to my story and my heart. And I think that only happens at a certain pace. A hurry is the enemy of attentiveness. So the love as attentiveness is listening and caring and noticing, cherishing, savoring, being awestruck. These things that we feel in a relationship, I am deeply loved by this person because they notice me. I think that that's how God's built it. And we can't get that if we're moving too fast, if we're in a hurry. Hurry does create often a form of attentiveness, but it's very tunnel visioned. So if I'm driving a car at a high speed, I have to be really attentive, but I can't look at the scenery. So I think let me back up a moment, because this has been an area I've spent a lot of books exploring. Again, it's partly curiosity, partly self-therapy, that slowness is a necessary component to letting things like virtue, like kindness, like love grow in us. That there are certain qualities, and they're the godlike qualities we're called to imitate. They're the fruit of the spirit things. And I don't think any of them can happen if we're in a rush. I think that's one of the reasons a lot of the programmatic ways of trying to make disciples in our churches is largely kind of failing in terms of the outputs and the outcomes and stuff, is we're trying to find a fast, efficient way to do what God never meant to have happen in a fast, efficient way, in a slow, effective way. Yes, but not a fast and efficient. So I don't think I've been saying it very well, Sherry, but I'm deeply intrigued by the pace of how certain things grow in us. On that score, I'd also say there's certain things that we don't want to cultivate that kind of erupt in us: hatred, bigotry, impatience, et cetera, that they are fast. They just move fast. They can happen fast. In fact, they sort of almost are a function of speed. I'm racing through traffic, and I was trying to get to the airport the other day and took a wrong turn. And, you know, I'm looking at the clock and I know when my flight goes, and my irritation at, you know, the drivers around me and stuff. Like, it just fast produces a certain characteristics, and slow does as well.
You know, as you talk, I think about the fact that, you know, throughout history, pilgrimage was considered a way of growing closer to God. Also, in some ways, considered healing to a certain extent.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a certain irony, but around the fact that something that is so uncomfortable and, you know, long and slow and painful, and, you know, there's hunger and soreness and thirst would heal. And I'd love to kind of hear your thoughts on that. Why would that be that something slow and painful, like a long walk, is healing physically as well as...
Yeah, so good. Well, I don't think anybody gets well at a soul level without fresh lessons in humility. I don't even know if I touched on this in the book, and if I ever get to rewrite portions, I probably will. I think walking is practicing humility, because we can't get there fast. We have to carry ourselves, and our self becomes weary, our self becomes vulnerable, our self becomes sore, our self becomes hungry, and all of, our self is exposed to the elements that we're not if we get in a car or a plane, etc. So there's an inbuilt humility in walking, and at the heart of pilgrimage, and this is different from what pilgrimage became in Rebecca Solnit documents, a shift from the pilgrimage to what now the walkathon, the march, etc., where those things have an external goal of we're going to raise money, or we're going to march on some place, we're going to march on your town, Washington, or whatever.
And also, like, you need to change rather than
You need to change. And pilgrimage is always what I need to change. The original pilgrimages were very much had a penitent component. That was probably the key motive. I have gone wrong in some way. Something's deeply awry in me. I've sinned. I've hurt somebody. The pilgrimage has sort of come back into fashion in many ways. And I think that penitent aspect is less a part, but the formative aspect where I will, if I go on this, there's going to be some revelation about me. I will probably be a penitent act. I will probably come to this place where I will face some things in me that I've avoided, I've denied, and they've become so glaringly obvious. And a lot of that has to do with that our bodies get tired, our bodies get sore. This sense of the inbuilt humility of walking that nothing else quite produces in the way just going for a very long walk does.
You know, your work talks not only about the way that walking teaches us about ourselves, our limitations and the like, but also about God. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about, I guess, the epistemology of walking, which is you compared your early walking with God with going to seminary, which you likened a little bit more to learning the map as opposed to walking the trail. And, you know, of course, both are very important in orienting oneself, but would love to hear you talk a little bit more about the kind of knowledge one gets about God as well as the world through walking rather than through cartography, through studying.
right. Yeah. And I totally agree that if theology is like cartography, it's a map. The skill or the ability to read a map is important for navigational things. The development of maps and ways to read them and ways to kind of locate yourself on them was absolutely crucial to the whole age of discovery and finding lands out there, not getting lost at sea or in the steppes or whatever. But a map itself is not the thing. A map itself orients us, guides us to wherever. But it's the walking that we discover really the landscape or the place where, or it's being in the landscape, whatever that seascape, whatever it happens, that we're actually experiencing the thing. But there's also, in terms of the relationship with God and why I compare where I, you know, my walking then and my walking now, my walking when I was going through seminary in terms of, and where I am now, is this hunger to learn really about God is a good hunger. And it's a hunger worth pursuing, a hunger worth feeding, where we try to get clarity about theology, doctrine, attributes of God. But in the end, that's not the same thing as knowing God. This is actually I studied under J.I. Packer, and this book, Knowing God, starts with this metaphor that he envisions two people standing on, standing watching from a balcony, and they're watching people walk by, and they're speculating about what they might see And I think they have a map, so they have some sense of what towns they might go through or forests they may pass through. But it's actually the person walking who maybe doesn't have all that information about where the trail goes that is actually going to experience the reality of that which they, you know, the land they walk and the places they walk. And Packer used that as a metaphor that knowing God needs some knowing about, but if we stop there, then it is a kind of almost a damnable thing where we become, you know, Paul says knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And I think that there's a puffing up of mere knowledge. I honestly, in my early academic years, I just embarrassed thinking back just as some of the ways I wielded, and that's the best word for it, knowledge. And I'm hopefully at the age now where I hope I'd never do that again. I hope I'd never weaponize knowledge.
You know, as you've been talking, one of the things I've not been thinking about is the fact that it's, in many ways, it's harder to walk now. You know, we have essentially kind of structured society where lots of suburbs and communities are really built for cars, not pedestrians. You know, right now here in Washington, we have really lousy air quality going
on. I'm sorry. I'm a Canadian. We love to say we're sorry, and I am sorry.
You know, crime, there's a lot of places where, you know, walking alone as a woman is to, you know, expose oneself to harassment. And so for a bunch of us who are still, you know, embodied creatures, you know, made to walk in and find ourselves in, you know, environments structured to make that difficult. What does one do? Like, why have we done that to ourselves, and what can we do about it?
Well, I don't know why we've done that to ourselves, other than I think the lust or the fetish for efficiency has so taken hold of the human project that we've dehumanized our public spaces. I actually kind of rate cities on their walkability. And not just in terms of, you know, I love walking in like Boston, the core of it's fun to walk. Parts of New York are fun to walk, not easy to walk, et cetera. But, you know, I look at, I'm in a Canadian, I'm confessing that because of the queer quality, but Vancouver is not really a great city to walk. I spend a lot of time, but they haven't attended to public trails. They have great parks, but to get from where you are to a park, you usually have to drive or you have to walk a lot of concrete. A city like Calgary, where I spend a lot of my time, has thought through from way back when they started urban development, public spaces to walk. So every community has not just great parks, but great walking trails in the city of Calgary, everyone. And you can virtually connect every community with every other community with walking trails. I think that should, I would love to see a renewal of urban planning in that, but it's giving up a lot of acreage for the sake of just people walking. So I don't know why we've done other thing. I think it's just sort of this fetish for efficiency. What to do about it is I everywhere I've gone, I've tried to walk, and some of the cities I walked in are some of the most difficult cities for all the reasons you just named: the air quality, they haven't been designed for pedestrians, the danger that is often present both through vehicles and through perhaps those you might come across. But I really do think that if we can use our vehicles to get to some place that is built for walking, and hopefully in terms of also some safety, some attention to safety, good lighting, everything kind of visible from every, to take advantage of that, even if it takes some effort to get to that place. And most cities, I've been in one city in, I'm forgetting the name now, but it was in the island of Borneo. And I could not find a single place that was designed for walking. And so I had very interesting walks on broken pavement, narrow broken pavement with cars nearly killing me. But most places in the world at least have somewhere within a, you know, maybe 5 to 10 minute drive, something that you can get out and with some safety actually. And there's trees around. Our trees, of course, are our lungs. So maybe the air quality will just be marginally better in that place than it is on a city street.
I wanted to ask, if people are listening to you and think like, you know, that sounds amazing, but when I go for a walk, that doesn't happen. you know, would love for you to kind of describe like what you do on a walk that enables it to be, you know, as rich an experience as you've described. And conversely, there may also be people watching who are handicapped or bedridden. Yeah. What is available to them?
Yeah. Oh, two fantastic questions. The first one, I don't want to, if I'm sounding like I'm ideal or romanticizing my own experience of walking, please know I have off and on a bung knee that will flare up at times, mostly inconvenient, where I planned a long walk and now I have to nurse the thing along the way. So some of my walks are painful. I have throughout most of my life suffered from intermittent back pain. And so sometimes I'm sort of working with some significant soreness or pain before I even start the walk. Sometimes the walk improves it. Sometimes it worsens it. And of course, part of I do have the advantage of going back and forth between two provinces in Canada, British Columbia and Alberta, where the walking is generally gorgeous. I live really close to the Rocky Mountains and the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. And then I live on a little island, and then I have some property in a place called the Okanagan Valley. And none of it is lacking for beauty and beautiful places to walk. But having said all that, I think that there still is, for me, getting out for a walk still is sort of an act of will. So it's not like I just leap out of bed and I'm just, you know, I'm raring to go. I have to summon myself to the act. I have to kind of sometimes coax and browbeat myself into the act of walking. And not just because of the things I talked about, some of the aches and pains I might have, but I'm fundamentally a lazy person. And so I think for those who are listening, I think that just basically like anything, it's a discipline. I argue in my book is a spiritual discipline, and no discipline is pleasant at the time, to quote Hebrews, but can produce stuff. So I think we just live into this larger reality and taste some of the benefits and also some of the struggles that we have to do it well. I do. Thank you for asking this, sort of our last question in this part of the conversation about those who can't walk. Sheree, as you know, I start the book and in part sort of make a shout out in the acknowledgement. So dear friend of mine, Norm Duick, who lost the ability to walk now about 12, 13 years ago. In one instance, he went from a very active man, very, very agile, to a quadriplegia, or is a bit distinct from that. He has some use of his hands, but I learned so much from him. I have never met a man who had a sweeter relationship with Christ than him, that he cultivated largely in the years he couldn't walk. So I then have a chapter all about those who can't walk. So I want to be highly attentive and sensitive to that. Norm is living proof for me that walking is not essential to the kind of things I'm commending in this book in terms of life with others, life with God, life attentiveness to yourself, self-awareness. He excels at that. He has more going on in his little finger than I have my whole body. But he's had to find means toward it that I have used walking often as sort of the way I cultivate that. But these things can be cultivated from a place of stillness. And so I think what I'm really doing in the book is inviting myself and then others to a certain way of knowing, a certain way of paying attention, a certain way of being still and knowing God and others and herself. And this can be done without your legs.
That's great. Thanks, Mark. And thank you for God Walk. I'm a walker myself and felt like I really stumbled onto something exciting when I read your book. So really appreciate it. And Mark, want to give you the last word.
Sure. Thank you. I'm going to read a brief poem by the poet Kai Miller. And it doesn't directly relate to walking, but it's thinking about the word in Genesis, let there be, let us, and the possibilities that happen in just walking with God. So it's called the Book of Genesis, Kai Miller. Suppose there was a book full only of the word let, from whose clipped sound all things began, fur and firmament, feather, the first whale. And suppose we could scroll through its pages every day to find and pronounce a let meant only for us. We would stumble through the streets with open books, eyes crossed from too much reading. We would speak in auto rhyme. The world would echo itself, and still we'd continue in rounds saying let and let and let, until even silent dreams had been allowed. So try to go for a walk today and let.
Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Be sure to subscribe to Trinity Forum Conversations podcast to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. And if you're enjoying these, please leave us a review. Visit our website at ttf.org for more information and show notes from this episode, as well as resources such as our Trinity Forum readings and videos from our past events.